a senior multi-faith educator, a global spiritual life at NYU, and this is Multi-Faithful, the podcast about religious diversity, multi-faith dialogue, and effing the ineffable. In this week's podcast, we are joined by Lodro Mintzler in another interview conducted by the great Rekha Prasad. This will actually be the final podcast of the year before we take a break for the summer, so thank you to those who have listened for the year. And now, without further ado, I'm going to kick it to Rekha and her conversation with Lodro.
So I want to welcome Lodro Mintzler here for us today. He has come to speak to us. He's one of our participants that came and was a panelist for our April 5th event, Buddhism Now, which focused on the next generation of teachers, which he is one. And we want to thank him for coming and spending some more time with us today to just continue the conversation and just talk a little bit more about his own practice and his background and what's coming up in his own community. So Lodro is a teacher in the Shambhala Buddhist lineage and the author of 5 books on meditation, including the best-selling The Buddha Walks Into a Bar and the award-winning books Walk Like a Buddha and The Buddha Walks Into the Office. Over the last 15 years, he has spoken at meditation centers, businesses, college campuses, and locations as diverse as Google, Harvard University, and Capitol Hill. Lodro's work has been featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Atlantic. In addition to serving as the Chief Spiritual Officer for Mindful, New York City's premier drop-in meditation studio, Lodro is the founder of the Institute of Compassionate Leadership. So thank you, Lodro, for being here today.
Thanks for having me in.
So I thought we'd just start out for our listeners, just a little bit about you, your practice, where how you came to it, just a little bio.
No, I guess I'm in a somewhat unique position in that I'm a second-generation American Buddhist. You know, my parents started studying Tibetan Buddhism back when they were in their 20s, and then it was always just around when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. Grew up here in New York City. And so I started meditating at a young age. Mm-hmm. Started doing weekend retreats when I was about 11, and then longer retreats. Went ahead and shaved my head, took the robes, did the monastic thing for the summer only, you know, like temporary ordination when I was a teenager, and then continued to study and do long retreats as a layperson after that. So it's sort of always been a part of my being. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I joke that, like, growing up in it, like, I didn't know if I was, like, certain things were because I was a meditator and, like, was I actually working with these things or was I just becoming older? Like, I don't know. Sort of grew up side by side with these things. So, yeah, and then the last 15 years I've been teaching meditation at the request of my teacher, Sakyong Mipam Rinpoche. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, I've written a couple books on it and things like that.
So tell me a little bit about that. What was that like being a kid in New York City growing up as a Buddhist?
Yeah.
Who, you know, not being what people probably typically think of as a Buddhist practitioner.
I mean, there's pros and cons, right? So
yeah.
Like the cons... Today, it's just much more socially accepted that one would meditate.
Mm.
It really has, just in the course of my lifetime, transformed.
Yeah.
So when I was a kid, you know, the only way that people really understood meditation is like, oh, Shaolin monks or, you know, like very like Hollywood stereotypical images of meditation because it wasn't as prevalent as it is now.
Yeah.
So it was a little lonely, I would say, being like the only kid that meditated.
Mm.
On the flip side, the big pro is that, you know, from a Buddhist perspective, it said that we're inherently awake. We're inherently good, basically good as we are.
Mm-hmm.
And to be raised with that as the viewpoint was profound. You know, I didn't have anything to compare it to. But now I look around and I have so many peers who said, you know, I grew up with the idea of original sin, for example.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just a completely different view. Not that there's anything wrong with any other religious traditions by any means, but to be raised with called the culture of no mistake, essentially. It's like, it's not that I'm bad if I do something wrong as a kid. It's like, oh, you did something wrong, but inherently you're good and whole and complete. You don't need external factors to make you happy.
Mm.
So that's a pretty profound view, I think, to raise children with, but,
yeah,
you know,
sure.
I'm very grateful for that. So it's both. There's the pros and the cons.
And so as a young person, since many of our listeners are college students, how did the practice sort of help you ride the waves of adolescence and your college years, or college age life, rather, and, you know, coming to adulthood?
It's a good question because, as I mentioned, you know, when I was 17, I did the monastic path and then went straight back and finished up my senior year of high school and then went on to college. And I actually had a moment where I was like, maybe I won't even go to college. Maybe I'll just stay. I was living at a meditation retreat center when I was 18.
Mm.
I thought, maybe I'll just stay here. And I had this wonderful interview with, you know, one of the greats in Tibetan Buddhism, like this past generation of like really wonderfully trained teachers who ended up fleeing Tibet when it was invaded by China. And, you know, I sat at the feet of this master and, you know, with all my 18 years of like naivete and wisdom, I said, you know, I would like to just pursue this path. Should I just stay here for the full year? And the translator translated, and he looked me in the eyes and goes, no. And it was basically like, go out and be in the world. Like, figure out how do you integrate the meditation practice with being a young person, which was such good advice for me. Because, you know, at that point, going forward, I was doing the traditional Tibetan Buddhist practices of like prostrations and mantra recitation, mandala creation, all these things. And as a freshman in college, I would like party, you know, I'd go out on Friday night and like go hard and wake up at 6 a.m. to then do prostrations and be like, you know, if you want to talk to anyone, if I don't claim to be the expert in many things, but if you want to talk to someone about about hangover meditation, like meditating well hungover, I'm your guy. Because it was really hard for me to find my own middle way with these things of being a young person and still holding to wanting to have a spiritual path and a really rigorous meditation practice. So for me, it meant drinking less and maybe even like being a little kinder, like doing 1 hour of practice instead of like 2 hours of practice or whatever, and just giving myself a break on both points and gradually figuring out what it means for me personally to be a college student and also a meditator.
Yeah. No, and I can imagine like a lot of our young people are dealing with a lot of extremes in their lives and in the messages they're getting, I think. So finding that middle path is not always an easy thing to do.
Yeah.
One of the things that's been coming up a lot around sort of current modern day practice is technology. And, you know, we've asked all of our panelists a little bit about that, since it can be our friend and our foe. And a lot of our young people are in social media and engaging in certain ways that aren't maybe as beneficial to them as it could be. But also getting a lot of stress and anxiety around it. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on technology and how young people can sort of manage it.
It's a great question. You know, with iPhones and social media, they're tools, essentially.
Yeah.
In the same way that a hammer is a tool. You know, I could use a hammer to hang a nail and put up beautiful art, or I could use a hammer to hit someone and cause physical harm. You know, it's not the hammer's fault. It's how I relate to that tool. So same thing in my experience with iPhones, laptops, social media, all of the various ways that technology manifests these days, Hulu, you know, like we could engage these things and say, oh, this is the time that I'm going to sort of like enjoy Facebook and then put a cap on it and go back to whatever we were actually wanting to focus on instead of just letting the mind wander and go freeform on these things. One of the key pieces of advice that I would like to offer in this particular regard, though, is a lot of us wake up with our phone also serving as our alarm clock. And then that means the first thing we do is pick up our phone in the morning. And after turning off the alarm, we might look at our calendar on the phone. We might open our email. We might look at Instagram. And before we've even had a chance to think about how we want to enter the day, we've already entered it. So either putting the phone on airplane mode if you want to continue to use it as an alarm clock so that you don't immediately like go straight into what do I need to react to eat first, or actually getting like an old school alarm clock. They still make them, you know. There's really wonderful, beautiful ones. So that we actually don't immediately go into reaction mode, reactivity. And we can be a little bit thoughtful. Like, what intention do I actually want to bring to my relationship with these things? Mm-hmm. How much time do I really want to devote to social media?
Mm-hmm.
And then feeling, again, the same thing with balancing, like, going out with friends and having a meditation practice. We have to balance our own personal middle way, figure out what works for us. And a lot of times, we don't get it right the first time. We learn from our mistakes. Well, I spent 2 hours looking, like going down a Wikipedia rabbit hole. that doesn't make me feel good.
Mm.
Next time I'm not going to do that. You know, it can be that simple that we start to discern what parts of our life and our relationship with social media and technology we feel good about and uplifted by, and when it actually hits that point that we need to cut it out.
And what about for those who are sort of using it as a means of avoidance? What would you say around, you know, it being another sort of form of kind of addiction in some ways?
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, 5-minute walk from NYU where, you know, we have Mindful, which is this drop-in meditation studio that has 30 and 45-minute classes all day, every day for people that want to just have a guided meditation experience with a certified instructor.
Yeah.
And all of our teachers come from Buddhist, Vedic, Kundalini, Jewish meditation, like all different backgrounds.
Mm.
So that people can explore what types of meditation really work for them.
Yeah.
And they all come in with this intention of like wanting to connect. And then they're waiting for class, and I see so many people just pull out their phones, and it's like the addiction, even in a beautiful space meant for meditation, it's not getting overwhelmed.
Mm.
So we encourage people to actually, like, when they check in, to just check their phone.
Mm.
And some people, that brings a lot of anxiety. Like,
yeah.
What happens?
Yeah.
Like, if my kid calls, it's like, well, then we'll pick it up. Like, well, if you need us to do something for you, we will.
Mm.
We try to make it very easy.
Mm.
But most people are like, okay, I get this. I am, like, my relationship to the phone has become a little bit too dependent. I'm going to try this out. I'm going to put my phone in this box and just leave it alone. And we've had a lot of really positive feedback for people saying, oh, I actually made like a new friend, a business connection, whatever it might be, because I was just hanging out and not in my own world.
Mm.
So I'd like to think that we're hitting that point with our technology where we realize that it's not always helpful and that we might want to change our relationship. We might even be moving to a post-technology zone of like, you know, we have camps these days that are like summer camp, no technology for the full week.
Mm.
Or, you know, spaces like ours where it's like no technology for the hour that you're in the space.
Right.
And people seem to enjoy that. So I think there are communities that are starting to look at this more wholeheartedly and say, Let me actually take a chance of changing my relationship to this because it's not always helpful to me.
Mm. So along those lines, what would you sort of talk about a little around social media or like social connections via technology versus in-person, face-to-face ways in which we can practice or engage with one another and how sort of Buddhism or mindfulness practices fit into that, the social media or the virtual versus the in-person?
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, everything has its place, right? And we could email back and forth with brilliant ideas, but at some point someone has to say, you know what, maybe we should just have a conversation.
Mm.
So it's knowing the best skillful means, I would say, for any given situation. Setting up a time to meet, you know, is great by email. Having a long political discussion is not great by email, right? Like,
yeah.
We have to start to think through exactly how much we really value being in our own little box with our computer and how much we really get out of one-to-one interactions.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in this, as we move towards this post-technology era where people are not wanting to only rely on their phones or only rely on their computers, we're going to start to see a lot more people say, you know what, I just want to get together with friends. And, you know, there's all these articles being written up about, like, dinners, you know, where you place your phone down.
Mm-hmm.
The first person to reach for it has to pay for the whole bill.
Sounds great.
Yeah. But there's something about just starting to engage and look at our relationship to technology that's important.
Yeah.
I think it doesn't make sense for me to say, here's the practical 10-step guidelines,
mm-hmm.
because it's such a personal relationship.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way relating to alcohol or eating meat or any of these things, it's a very personal relationship for an individual to figure out what makes most sense for me. Like, what is my relationship to this? Do I need to look at it, change it, etc.?
Mm. And so when we're talking about, you know, all of these things and it being sort of a personal decision and how we're relating to one another, I'm curious around the conversation that's arising in the Buddhist world, but in a national conversation around sort of racial justice and social justice and sort of feeling that we're responsible for one another as well, and how that kind of fits in that with our practice and some of these principles. What is the role of the Buddhist practitioner or a mindfulness person in all of this as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because one of the things that I work a lot with is the lack of diversity within Buddhism in America.
Mm.
You know, as a white male myself, I have a certain positionality and a certain level of privilege that if I'm not going to stand up and actually raise the red flag when things are unjust, then who is, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Which is why, you know, whenever I have an opportunity to build a community like Mindful or, you know, the Institute for Compassionate Leadership, the nonprofit I founded a few years ago,
mm-hmm.
it's very important to me that we actually include diverse leadership so that people actually understand that there is a place as you continue to grow and you know, there's wonderful role models of people who come from all backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, within Shambhala, there's this story of this legendary kingdom where Dalazangpo, the king of this kingdom, heard tale of the Buddha, went in search of him and said, listen, I live in the world. I can't become a monastic. There's too many people that rely on me. Are there any teachings you can offer? And the Buddha is said to have sent all the monastic followers out of the room and imparted the Kala Chakra Tantra, which are teachings on mindfulness and compassion, how to actually be in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And Dalazangpo goes home and starts to have conversations with people in his kingdom. So in my mind, it's a conversation sitting down with his ministers and saying, hey, you know, how could we actually live in line and raise our kids in ways that are more mindful?
Mm-hmm.
And then he sits down with the generals and says, how can we compassionately take care of our soldiers? And all these sorts of things. And over time, this kingdom became inclusive of everyone.
Mm-hmm.
People from all racial backgrounds, sexual orientation, gender identity, religious institutions, like all sorts of people came in under this umbrella of mindfulness and compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And that kingdom, this legendary kingdom, was said to have been called Shambhala,
mm-hmm.
which is the source of the name of the tradition I find myself a part of in teaching it. So it's a beautiful story, but there's so much work to be done
mm-hmm.
here as Buddhism comes to America. And it's important for all of us, in my mind, to have those conversations. It's like, that's the amazing part of the story for me. It's not like this king went back and decreed, we are inclusive of it. It was like, no, this is an organic thing
mm-hmm.
where we start to say, oh, this is interesting. It's all white people leading this panel. You know, like, is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
Do we all feel good about that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really basic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's gotten to the point within my community where I'm a little bit difficult with everyone. but, you know, for example, there's often opportunities for me to co-teach. And at this point, I will co-teach with just about anyone so long as they're not another white man.
Mm.
And people know that.
Mm.
And I'm pretty clear. Because it's not just racial inclusivity, it's also gender inclusivity. And, you know, I think we still have a very, very long way to go, but at least these conversations are starting to happen, at least in my own particular Buddhist community.
So what would you say to those who are sort of like, but that's not what the Dharma is about, or that's not what Buddhism is not about, like sort of where we see beyond these things? Like that's often what comes up.
Oh, sure.
In the resistance, you know?
Well, I love it. I mean, it's a great question because it's like talking about absolute versus relative reality, right?
Right.
On an absolute level, we're entirely empty of substantive nature,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, I can look at my hand and say, oh, I think of this as a hand, but really it's just skin and bone and muscles and blood flowing through it. And then, you know, if I lost this hand, would I still be Lodro? You know,
mm-hmm.
we can get into all this, like, from a Tibetan Buddhist perspective, Madhyamaka logic around the absolute nature of reality
mm-hmm.
and the fact that my hand is only made up of cells and the fact that all the cells in my body die over the period of 7 years. So even though I think I'm a solid human being, in fact, I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I have a whole other body after 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the ways that we think about ourselves and our world around us, we have to start to realize that it's a little bit more fluid than we might originally think.
Mm-hmm.
I get that. And at the same time, I got to go to work on Monday,
right.
which is the relative level of, like, how do we show up in the world?
Mm-hmm.
How do we actually embody the principles? A lot of times when people get really rigid about sort of the absolute or ultimate nature of the Buddhist teachings, they forget the teachings on compassion and kindness.
Mm.
It's actually doing the teachings a disservice to forget the relative Mahayana or greater vehicle path
mm.
of actually just being there for other human beings. So it's incredibly important. And I mean, the Buddha himself led by example. You know, he actually allowed women to join the monastic order, which was a huge FU to the institutional norms of the time.
Mm.
And he actually brought in people from all different socioeconomic castes. Like, there were all sorts of rules that were immediately broken in Indian culture because the Buddha said, no, this is the right thing to do. We actually have to practice what we preach.
Mm.
So for purists, you can even look to the Buddha as an example. But I think just on a everyday level, we need to realize that there is two forms here. We can get very lost and heady in the teachings, but if we're not connecting to our heart, then we're missing the whole point.
Yeah. And that idea of it being embodied practice, so what does that actually look like, you know, in our, in this idea that I have to go to work on Monday or I have to go to class on, you know, Friday evening? What does that look like in the day-to-day life?
Yeah. Well, there's, in my experience, actually, okay, so there's very, very traditional Tibetan Buddhist teachings around what's known as the great perfection, you know, really waking up in a big way. And it says that people with the highest caliber of capability, they're able to just get it.
Mm-hmm.
They just get it automatically. And then there's people like you and me who, I don't mean to make an assumption about you, maybe you're already completely enlightened.
No, definitely not.
I'm just blind. but, you know, there's people like you and me, it says, okay, then people with like more middling capabilities, we have to meditate until we start to really understand what these teachings mean to us.
Mm-hmm.
And then people of lesser capabilities, this is a very traditional list that this would be called lesser, we have to bring it into our conduct.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's both how much can I actually cultivate the qualities that the Buddha discussed when I'm doing my main practices, and then how much am I able to then manifest them off the cushion, either practically and consciously or just completely unconsciously, because we call it meditation practice.
Mm-hmm.
And we're practicing for all of the waking hours of our life so that we can embody those qualities going forward. So it's both. We either consciously or unconsciously, it happens.
Absolutely. So you talk a little bit about, like, the purists, so to speak, about this practice, although I guess that's questionable too.
Sure, that's true.
And then sort of what it looks like off the cushion. We're moving into this interesting time right now with sort of the mindfulness coming into mainstream society and taking off in ways that at least those of us who are in the world think it's going crazy, but I think the majority of the culture doesn't quite know it yet. But I'm curious about your thoughts around that, around like what it is to be a teacher, what sort of Western mindfulness means versus being a Buddhist, being an out Buddhist in some ways, and just where it's going and what your thoughts are around all of that.
It's a very good question. I mean, there's a lot in there,
yeah.
But I think it would actually surprise people to hear how much of a traditionalist I am, considering I founded something called Mindful, which is just meditation.
Yeah.
That's all we do.
Yeah.
We just offer meditation styles. And there are a lot of people out there that are all of a sudden just offering meditation in corporate settings, through apps, through YouTube videos. But when I say I'm a traditionalist, I think a lot of the people who are get involved in, quote-unquote, the meditation businesses don't necessarily know what meditation is themselves.
Right.
So, for example, I know of one or two situations where people started a meditation business and then started meditating. You know? Like,
right. Yeah.
And it frustrates the hell out of me.
Yeah.
You know? As someone who's been teaching this for 15 years, it's really important to me that whoever I work with has a lot of integrity within their own tradition.
Mm.
And they've been extremely well-trained. Because, yes, I mean, if we think of an iceberg, the tip of the iceberg could just be, you know, here you take this posture, you talk about the breath, and then you talk about coming back to the breath. But then right below the surface, there has to be a gazillion ways of working with people who are suffering from depression, just have a lot of trauma come up, who want to actually get involved in the teachings. And for me, it's like, I just thought about this morning. I thought, you know, a good question if you're wondering, like, whether you can trust someone who's teaching meditation, you could ask them very basic things like, what's the difference between Tibetan and Zen Buddhism?
Mm.
What's the difference between Buddhism and Vedic meditation?
Mm.
You know, stuff like this. And see if they have anything right below that surface.
Mm.
Because it's important that people who teach these things are really knowledgeable and are able to really care for the whole being, as opposed to just give, like, talk in a soothing voice and talk about how you should lift up through your spine. Like, that's bullshit.
Right.
Now that you've gotten me heated. But that's why at Mindful we have 28 different teachers, but they all come from different traditions.
Mm.
So someone might have done a teacher training many, many years ago within the Insight Meditation Society tradition. You know, someone else might have done something within the Gelugpa tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. Someone else might have done something within the Kundalini world. But like they all have teachers who had teachers who had teachers who had teachers that goes back hundreds, if not thousands of years.
Mm.
So no one made this shit up last Tuesday.
Right.
And that's the difference. Time-tested techniques as opposed to, well, this worked for me, so I'm going to start offering it to people. So this is where I get very traditionalist about it.
No, and that makes, I mean, I'm right there with you. I absolutely agree with you. And what about the idea of those who are of Buddhist backgrounds and do have, like, long lineages of behind them and who are well-trained but somehow don't talk about it and
yeah.
and are really shy around talking about that or hesitant to?
Yeah, I mean, this gets way back to when I talked about growing up in this. It's like I never thought that anyone would actually want to have a conversation about these things.
Yeah.
If you asked me 10 years ago, you know, I'd already been teaching, but like even at that point, I was shy about it and also never expected anyone would be interested in this.
Mm-hmm.
So it's gone through this. I think we're still catching up, those of us that have been doing this for a while,
mm-hmm.
with the idea that we have to sort of come out of the closet a little bit more about
mm-hmm.
Our own practice and our own experience about practice and why this might be helpful to people, and not in a proselytizing way, but just being available to those who might want to find out. And it's interesting, even though we only teach, you know, meditation at Mindful, because everyone has a tradition, at a certain point they say, well, I like these teachers. You know, I like David and I like Joe and I like Paulette. It's like, great, go study at Shambhala. They're all Shambhala teachers.
Mm.
You know, like, we only do half-hour and 30 and 45-minute classes. If you want a weekend retreat, go there.
Mm.
You know, if you love Zen, go there.
Mm.
So we think of ourselves a little bit like a revolving door in that way, which is fine, where people connect to a tradition, and then they don't want to go deep. There's going to be a layer of people that only want to do meditation.
Right.
And then there's going to be people that say, I want to connect with that spiritual tradition from which this comes from.
Mm.
So for us, I think it's a really interesting translation act. I don't sit there and I don't talk about the six paramitas of Buddhism.
Mm.
I talk about generosity and how that actually applies to your daily life.
Mm.
I talk about how to be patient when things are really hard. You know, it's actually the qualities themselves.
Yeah. And so do you think if you just meditate every day and you don't sort of, is it possible to quote unquote get it if you're just meditating and not sort of studying beyond?
Yeah. I mean, when we founded the Institute for Compassionate Leadership, I thought, all right, we've got meditation, but we also have community organizing training. We also have practical leadership skills. If people space out through all of that,
mm-hmm.
and they've only been meditating for the 6 months of the program,
mm-hmm.
they're still going to end up more compassionate.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I really believe that, like, we have to have some faith in the practice itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that through looking at the ways that we get stuck in our own mind and ways that we act out and the ways that our storyline, our habitual storyline plays out, we start to notice and how we suffer. And then we start to notice other people in our world, our view gets larger and we say, oh, that person suffers just like I do.
Mm.
It's not me versus them, it's us. It's actually the birth of compassion. We're no longer way above someone saying, oh, you poor non-spiritual people down there, you don't meditate. It's
mm.
actually like looking someone in the eyes and saying, oh, you are totally hooked by anger. I know what that's like.
Mm.
I totally know what that's like because I've looked at it a lot. Mm. So I think compassion naturally starts to manifest. The teachings are very helpful in supporting these things. And obviously, if someone is interested in doing Buddhism or another religious tradition that emphasizes teachings around meditation, they should.
Mm-hmm.
But I totally recognize it's not going to be for everyone. I still think it's very beneficial.
And along those lines, like there have been a lot of these sort of certification programs. I'm always so curious to hear from teachers what they think about that. Like people who are actual long-term practitioners and who've studied versus these sort of 1 year or, you know, depending on what they're sort of talking about. I'm curious what you think about these programs.
It's a great question. You know, for me, as I came up through meditation, I didn't yearn to be a teacher. I was put in a situation at university where I tried to get teachers. We were geographically isolated, and my teacher said, you should do it because you actually have done all the requirements and you can go on this meditation teacher training retreat.
Mm-hmm.
And I did.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was just for a basic introduction to meditation, like how to actually, that tip of the iceberg I talked about earlier.
Mm.
And then a couple years later, I did a more in-depth training and then continued on. I did one a couple months ago. Like I continue to go deeper with my own understanding of what it means to be a teacher. And
mm.
I think that's important.
Mm.
So again, I'm a little traditional about this, but I think anyone again can set up set themselves up and say, I'm a meditation teacher, because they did a week-long retreat with Tara Brach, and, you know, poor Tara isn't going to, like, certify anyone by any means, but they're like, she's my teacher. I took a retreat with her, so now I'm going to teach what she taught me. You know, it's like, I've seen that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very confusing. I don't mean to pick on Tara. Like, I just
happened to someone
wrote me the other day. And I said, oh, what are you trained in? And they said that. And I thought, oh, well, actually, I don't think you're certified to teach, which is a painful thing to say to someone. But there are real training programs within given lineages, which I think are wonderful. And then, as you said, there's all these things that are popping up, in particular online.
Yeah.
And I think it's a little bit like... in the same way that if someone wanted to officiate their friend's wedding, they could go online and get like a ordination through a ministry that basically exists just to give the certification.
Right, right.
Same thing with meditation teachers. Mm. There's a lot of programs out there where it's not a real credential. So I think that if people are really interested in pursuing the path of being a teacher, it's important to get involved in a particular lineage or tradition. You know, I'm so curious because there are some being offered here in New York that I wholeheartedly respect, like the Interdependence Project has a year-long teacher training, which is really a deep immersion in Buddhism. That's wonderful. And we work with some of their teachers at Mindful, and I think they're really wonderfully accessible teachers, and they're really knowledgeable at the same time. You know, there's a 100-hour training somewhere happening in the city that I'm curious to see what that will look like, and whether those people feel like they graduate and have a really deep understanding of these various traditions. As to whether Mindful would ever do that, it's a good question. It would have to be with people who have a lot of meditation experience and the best of intentions. That's the real thing.
Intention is a big component of things as well. And so, you know, we have a lot of young people who are kind of coming to us with all sorts of anxiety and, like, mental health issues and OCD and eating disorders, you name it, right? Who are really trying to find something to help them through those things. So as you said, to be able to hold that for people who are going through it, what have you seen in your constituency or your community that has really spoken to rising mental health issues for,
It's a good question. You know, my first job out of college, I was running the Boston Shambhala Center. And I quickly thought, okay, what's the one thing that everyone here has in common? Because it was a really wonderfully diverse community. And I thought, oh, everyone's coming here because they've tried just about anything else to alleviate their suffering. You know, people with a lot of health issues, a lot of quarter life or midlife crisis, and things like that. You know, I just led a week-long meditation retreat in Colorado. And I was like, at a certain point, I looked at my stuff. I thought, is there anyone here who's taking this program who hadn't just lost someone right before they got to this retreat?
Wow.
You know, it was really like someone's mother died, someone's uncle died. Like, there was just like a giant, like, I'm seriously suffering. I'm going through a lot of grief. I'm going through a lot of, you know, things in my own life. I think I'll just go lock myself up for a week in a meditation retreat. It was really interesting to see, okay, you know what? I've heard this can help. I'm going to try it. That willingness is really wonderful. And thankfully, it was. I think, you know, that week of meditation was really helpful for people. But I think it takes more time than we want it to be. You know, we're so used to instant gratification in our culture, where someone's like, oh, this guy wrote books, I'll go on Amazon, you can have the book delivered. You know, if you're feeling hungry while you listen to this, you can get Chinese food delivered. You know, like, there's lots of, like, instant gratification. Meditation and Buddhism is not that. It's like a long path of actually starting to get familiar with how we suffer and the brilliant and full of potential parts of ourselves as well. But, you know, my favorite word for meditation in the Tibetan tradition is gom, G-O-M. It's translated as become familiar with, in addition to meditation. So it's equating meditation as a way to become familiar with all of who we are. And the more we do that, the same way if we met a friend at a party, we would want to become familiar with them. And the more we become familiar with them, the more we really value that friendship. And the more we value that friendship, we might look at that person in a couple months, a year, and say, oh, I love my friend. If we could do that with ourselves, that would be huge. And that's what meditation is. So it's us starting to say, oh, I'm going to look at some of the big things that are coming up in my life and start to become familiar with that as an act of befriending myself. And then down the road, we may even find that we love ourselves.
That's really beautiful. Along the lines of the opposite of that, which is sort of in the everyday life, you know, like in the instant gratification component, how does this look like? What does this look like, rather? Like, how do we bring it off the cushion and into the daily life of being in New York City? And, you know, a lot of our students are here in New York for the first time in their lives and managing not only the stress of college, but the stress of the city, riding subways and being with millions of other people on the street. How does this serve that?
Yeah, it's hard. Yeah. I think this is a particularly aggressive, speedy city. Mm. You know, there's some places that one could live where it just feels a little bit smaller and you feel a little bit less anonymous. And I think that's why it's important to join communities that really do support you and feel spacious to you. I mean, it's been wonderful to serve. I mean, Mindful's all at 5.5 months old, and it's been wonderful to build a community from the ground up that's based around the principles of just being kind and spacious, that people can come in and it's quiet.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's huge in this city, to actually find a quiet space and to connect with people in a kind and authentic way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it doesn't have to be us. Just finding those communities that you feel at home at. And a lot of, there's so many wonderful meditation centers here in the city.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there is something to be said of just taking care of yourself. It's hard to see the sort of daily toll of being crammed on a subway and tensing up your body and being bombarded by the noise of a jackhammer out on the street. Like, we don't think, oh, this is having a negative effect on my body, but it is, you know? So it's actually doing ways that we can actually take care of ourselves. And there's this ancient set of teachings in Tibet that were guarded for centuries in the monasteries for whatever reason. And they're known as the four exhilarations. And it said if you do all four of these things in a day, you have sustained energy and you feel uplifted.
Mm.
They are eat well, sleep well, meditate, exercise, right? It's like, why this was so guarded, I do not know. But it's, we don't do all four of those in a day more often than not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we might sleep in and then we say, oh, I have no time for breakfast, and skip that meal. We might have to choose between exercise and meditation because we can't have time for both. We have lots of ways of sort of shortchanging ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So to try to balance these four things of eating well, sleeping well, meditation, and exercise in a day, it's actually quite profound.
Well, I want to thank you. I think those are all lovely ideas and wonderful advice for our young people. Please check out Mindful, which is right around the corner from NYU, or come to one of our sits as well and do just that, self-care in this crazy world. So again, I want to thank Lodro for taking the time to be with us. Please check out the panel discussion that we had. It's up on YouTube, and be sure to come by Mindful NYU as well and just give us a shout out. So thanks again, Lodro. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Multifaithful, and to those of you who have been listeners throughout the year, thank you for joining us. This has been a really fun journey for our office and for me personally, and we hope to have you back next year as we record more episodes. A special, special, special thank you to Brian Young, who did an incredible amount of work editing and producing the podcast this year, and to everyone in the office for contributing in their various ways, Yael Shai, Jiran Perez, and of course Rika, who appeared in the podcast a few times. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions over the summer, please be in touch at spiritual.life@nyu.edu. Please don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes, and we look forward to having you back next season. Thanks so much for listening.